Please go ahead. This afternoon's conference call is now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RRTPD Working Group call on Monday, 3rd of June. On the call today, we have James Bladel, Kevin Erdman, Angie Graves, Volker Grayman, Oliver Hope, Bob Mountain, Mikey O'Connor, Holly Raich, Jill Titzer, and Grammy Bunton. We have apologies from Avery Doria, Simonetta Batteghe, Alan Greenberg, Bartlett Morgan, Chris Chaplow, and Michaela Nealon. And yes, sorry. And from staff, we have Marika Konings, Lars Hoffman, and myself, Julia Chavonin. May I remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Julia, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IRTPD working group call for June the 3rd. As per our usual standard operating procedures, does anyone have any updates to their statement of interest? If so, please indicate by raising your hand. Seeing none, we'll move on to the approval of the agenda. The draft agenda was circulated to the mailing list earlier and appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe chat screen. Any comments or additions to that agenda? Okay, great. We'll consider that agenda adopted, and we'll move on to item number two. Last week, thanks to all of the diehards who showed up on the on the holiday, I guess it was the holiday in the U.S. and I believe in some other areas as well, like a banking holiday maybe in parts of Europe. So thanks for those who put in the time and gave us an hour out of their free time. For those who didn't, I want to assure you that we didn't really dive into substance so much as perform, I think, some very necessary housekeeping activities, which was going back through the comments that we had already discussed in the comment review tool and trying to boil down the essence not only of the issues raised in the comment but also what the working groups, not the response necessarily, but what the working group needed to discuss, what the salient points were for each comment. And I think that's where we want to continue because if you recall, and I think everybody has scrolling capabilities, if you recall, it looks like we've got just a few more comments that we need to review beginning on page 6 of the comment review tool that's currently displayed. So anyone have any questions or comments before we dive into that exercise? Anyone from the call last week that wanted to weigh in before we charge up? Mikey, any thoughts?
This is Mikey. I think the main point is that the additions that we made last week are clearly draft, that if there's anything in there that people see that they want to correct, we're going to circle back around to those and make sure that the rest of the group agrees with them. But it was pretty useful to be able to come up with sort of a summary. I think that out of these summaries, we may get some material that will be helpful for going into the Durban meeting and kind of focusing the conversation there. So I agree with James. It was terrific that some of us could take that time for sort of an administrative thing, but kind of a clarifying thing as well. It was great. Thanks, James.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. The queue is clear, so if you don't mind, we'll dive right into comment number 9. And now we are discussing charter question E. Are existing penalties for policy violations sufficient, or should additional provisions of penalties for specific violations be added into the IRTP? The first question comes from the business constituency. The BC believes there should be penalties for specific violations other than notice of breach. The BC hopes that the 2013 RAA has addressed this issue. I'll take a cue on this question, and particularly if anyone from the BC would like to weigh in. Chris or anyone else, I have some thoughts as well, can weigh in from the perspective of the 2013 RAA, which is a draft document at this point, but I think everyone believes that for the most part it is in an adoptable state. Any thoughts here, Chris?
Yes, just happy to, just to mention, as you know, the RAA, when this was written, was a bit of a moving target, and I and a few others were aware, but not experts in the RAA, which is why we put that comment in a very general, in a general sense. So, in fact, you can probably know far more about it than we do. I think the RAA has picked up on some of these points. Isn't that correct?
I threw myself in the queue, but I would certainly yield to anyone else that would like to weigh in on this. Okay. So the draft RAA as it stands now does include more of a gradient type of enforcement or sanction structure for ICANN compliance, which includes so things like suspension, where a registrar would not be able to add new domain names or accept transfers, but still allow their registrant customers to manage existing names. So that would be one, you know, possible gradient of sanctions. I think that from my own perspective, and I'm going to put my registrar hat on here, I would hate to get to a point where every consensus policy had its own structure for penalties for violating that specific policy. I do believe that having an overarching structure exist in the RAA, being the primary document, is probably the right way to go, and that any breach of any provision of the RAA or any existing consensus policy that was enforced would be dealt with uniformly. And that's just my opinion as a registrar, and I certainly would welcome any comments on that. I think we should have passed out coffee, Mike.
Well, one of the other things I have to learn is how to unmute quickly. It's like 15 feet away. But, you know, as long as I'm on, this is Mikey, I think I really support that idea. And I think that it's also supported in the comments by registries that, you know, policies go into this thing called the picket fence. Chunk of the contract that registrars and registries need to abide by. The sanction and enforcement structure, doing that policy by policy, is a bad enough idea. I think that we actually might want to put that in as sort of a key discussion point, because although we wouldn't be able to enforce that across all the other policies, we could certainly raise the issue for discussion outside of the RTP, and I think it would be a really useful one. So I agree.
Okay, so Mikey, you're proposing that we specifically or explicitly state that policies should not have individual sanction structures, that we are leaning on things like the RAA and the registry agreement and their built-in enforcement mechanisms. And I think Chris wants to weigh in on that one. Chris, go ahead.
Yes. Difficult to speak to the BC because that detail was never discussed, or that idea of having individual sanctions or whatever within an individual PDP was never discussed. And I suppose I have to be careful here, but I have to speak to myself. I don't think it was ever contemplated. And speaking for myself, that's not where we're heading or I'm heading to at all. I think something much more overarching, like Mike and you've suggested. Whether that should be mentioned in this working group's report, just to flag it, might be worth it. Then nobody comes back later and says, "Oh, I thought you meant such and such."
Thanks, Chris. Mikey?
Yeah, this is Mikey. I like this a lot, but I also think it's outside our scope. I mean, I think that what we could do is acknowledge this issue in our report and suggest that the council contemplate, I don't know whether it requires a PDP or not, but at least some action, since, you know, we weren't really charged with the sanction structure outside of ours, but we could acknowledge that this is a pretty interesting issue and sort of let the council chew on that a bit from our report. I have to cogitate about exactly how to word it. I think we're all pretty heartily in agreement. It's just, you know, how much authority do we have in our charter to recommend that outside of the IRTP? I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. I tend to agree. I think we're all, you know, vigorously nodding our heads, but this wasn't necessarily what we wanted to see, but the concern being that, you know, future PDPs may take it upon themselves, and situationally it may be appropriate. It's hard to imagine why, but it could be, I suppose. But future PDPs don't have to listen to us, I guess, in that regard. And so, but I think explicitly stating that we considered this and that we don't believe that's the right direction, and that we think that the council should and that other working groups should, should stay away as well. I don't know. While recognizing that we can't tell them that, it's more of a recommendation. I think that's kind of where we're going with this. Any other thoughts on comment number 9 before we move to comment number 10? Okay, so with an empty queue, we'll move on to comment number 10, which is from the Registry Stakeholder Group. And once again, this was submitted in response to the preliminary report and not the comment period. So with the modifications introduced in the 2009 Registrar Accreditation Agreement that provide for enforcement measures for noncompliance, the Registry Stakeholder Group is satisfied that there are adequate remedies to encourage resolution and noncompliance with IRTP and TDRP. So the registries, I think, are coming down the same area that we are. I think the BC took it one step further and notes that there are even more enhanced or more flexible compliance tools in the 2013 draft RAA than are current in the 2009 RAA. So I think that the two comments as well as the discussions on the group are fairly solidly in agreement with each other. Mikey.
This is Mikey. So maybe what we do is we tentatively say, is there anybody who thinks that the answer to this question is anything else? In other words, is our answer, the short version answer, yes, there are sufficient existing penalties? Because this would be a good time, if you don't think that there are sufficient penalties, this would be a good time to throw up your hand and let us know about that.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. I think now would be, you know, when we find a low-hanging fruit like this during our work, we should identify it as such as early as possible. But recognizing there's a lot of folks that aren't on the call that may also want to weigh in, but we don't want to assume that silence is a consent here. So anyone else on the call have any strong thoughts, particularly if you object to where the conversation is going on item number or charter question E? Seems like we're all saying that the existing penalties, particularly in the 2009, but especially in the draft 2013 RAA, are sufficient. I think perhaps we might want to include in our statement that that is also true of the registry agreement, although they have very little, I want to say their role is reduced in that. Holly, go ahead. Holly, your hand was up and then it went down. Does that mean we we convinced you or we addressed your concerns? Or okay. Okay, so let's move on to...
James, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, Mikey, go ahead.
Holly's got stuff in the chat that we could just read.
Oh, I
She's
see.
Happy with the approach.
But okay.
She wants us to explain. Yeah, as we've done, that the RAA addresses this joint. There you go. So just wanted to get that chat in. Sorry.
That's a good point, and it looks like Holly is on mute. So sorry about that. I didn't. Misunderstood the silence. And thanks for watchdog in the chat box, Mikey, because I missed that. Okay, so let's move on to charter question F, which we picked up from, I believe, our last working group, if I'm not mistaken, IRTPC. Charter question F reads, did the universal adoption and implementation of EPP auth info code eliminate the need of standard forms of authorization FOA? So a little context here. The discussion of FOAs or forms of authorization during the last iteration of IRTP noted that the technical implementation uses auth info codes, which is a randomly generated, or let's say a registrar generated code that is stored in the registry database alongside the registration, that is, for lack of a better word, a password for the domain name registration, is necessary to effect the transfer. Does that eliminate the need for the email authorization that is currently required in the IRTP policy, not only for the gaining registrar, but now, as per, I believe, IRTPB, maybe C, I'm getting my IRTPs confused, but one of the previous working groups also recommended that this be required for the losing registrar as well as a confirmation of the intention to transfer the domain name. So the thinking here is that do we still see a need to pass these email authorizations back and forth, or does the fact that the new registrar has access to the auth info code, which is only available to the registrant via their old registrar, does that eliminate the need for these authorizations? And we have comments here from the BC and from the registry. So, but looks like Bob wants to jump in first, so we'll defer to Mr. Mountain. Go ahead.
Sorry, James, this is Bob. Yeah, sorry, I had a clarifying question, but if it's more appropriate to go through the comments first, I'm happy to hold off and resubmit my question later as appropriate.
No, please make sure that we're all on the same page before we dive into the comments. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess my question was the auth info, obviously, the FOA, contains a lot of information about the transaction, IP address of the requester or the acquirer, other information about the gaining and losing registrants. Is it envisioned, or is the current EPP transaction contain that information, or would this be a change for the registrars to alter their system to include information that is currently contained within the FOA? Or is the thinking that this information is not required at all and would somehow be reconstructed through the EPP codes? So I'm just a little confused on how we'll treat the information that's currently in the FOA going forward if we were to make a change like this. That's all.
Yeah, it's a good question, Bob, and I don't have a ready answer for you. I think that the answer is, just kind of putting my hat on here a little bit, is closer towards the second part of your statement, that it would be that this is the EPP auth info code is happening in code between the registry and registrar, and that the FOA is happening sort of external to that process. And that the question is, can we just eliminate that second part of the process and only go by the auth info code? I think that's what it's asking. I know we had a vigorous discussion on this last time around and the security implications of that. So I'm sure we'll get into some of those questions again. But I think that just to clarify what's being asked, I think is closer to the second part of your statement.
Got it. Understood. Okay. Thanks, James.
And then I have a clarifying question of my own, which I don't know if I have an answer for. The question seems to assume that EPP is universally adopted and implemented, if we look at the first few words. Is that true? Are there GTLD registries out there that don't use EPP? I think the answer is no, but I want to be sure that, because I know that, for example, there are country codes where registrars can still use a web interface, or even FAT. Volker's going to smack me here, but I think even .de still allows a fax interface. So that's a question. Are there any legacy systems like that with GTLDs? And that might be a question more for the registry stakeholder group to take away as homework. So let's take a look at the comments, unless other folks wanted to weigh in on what the question is saying. Bob's pointing out that postal mail is still used for Denmark. Yeah, I think that's true of someplace in South America or the Caribbean as well, where it's postal mail only. So some of the country codes out there do not universally implement EPP, but the question is that true of any GTLDs, or are they all uniformly on using EPP and using auth input codes the same way? So looking at comment number 11 for the business constituency, it says, in the day-to-day administrations, the FOA are redundant. However, in cases involving unauthorized transfer requests in which the registered nameholder's email address has been hijacked or its access credentials to the control panel have been stolen, the gaming registrar's obligation to obtain the FOA from either the registered nameholder or the admin contact can help protect the domain names from being hijacked. Given the registered name holders, who is the contact information is different from the admin contract. So I think the gist of this question, and maybe we can ask Chris and some others from the BC to weigh in, is that, in the vast majority of transfers, the FOAs are redundant. However, in those cases where there is a hijack or compromised registrar account or a dispute between the registrant and the admin contact, the FOAs are a useful paper trail to help, resolve that dispute and reverse it. Am I correctly characterizing that comment? Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, James. This is Bob. I couldn't agree more, to be honest. I think to remove something that allows you to that gives you more information about the transaction and the parties involved. To remove that, I'd be very, very concerned about anything like that. Unless we were looking at consolidating functionality, which would involve work by everyone. So I strongly support the concern that point 11 is raising. That's all.
Thanks, Bob. Any other folks want to weigh in on this? On this comment from the BC?
Yeah.
Oh, was that Holly? Graham, go ahead.
Hey there, it's Graham Bunden from TwoCast. I think that the redundant point is worth talking about because it does mean that for registrants, they're getting multiple codes, and I think it frequently causes some confusion. It also sounds like there's no other mechanism for gathering that information that the FOA provides. So I don't have a solution, but it causes problems having both, I think. So I guess that's sort of a general comment on FOA and EPP and not just that particular BC comment, but there you go.
Thanks, Graham. And I think that, that's the first clause of their comment reinforces your point there about, in the day-to-day use or the vast majority of transactions, it would be redundant. Put myself in the queue, but I will go to Lars first.
Hi, this is Lars. Hey, thanks, Lars. James. Just a quick note. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Yep. All right, sorry. I'm sure I'm on the Adobe Connect. Just to let you know that the you might remember from the Beijing briefing, the ICANN compliance also provided some views on the various questions, and their points on this might actually be relevant. They mentioned, similar to what has been said, that concerning legitimate transfers, it may be seen redundant to have the auth info code sent by the registered name holder. But they then go on and explain how an unauthorized transfer still might be useful. If you want, I can either pull up the whole thing or just paste the answer into one of the pods on the side so you can read it through if you would like.
Thanks, Lars. I think that would be relevant. And if you could paste that into the chat, we could circle back on that. Graham, I didn't know if you wanted to weigh in, but your hand just went down, so I'm assuming you don't.
This is Lars, just very quickly. I pasted on the right.
Oh, I see.
Sorry, I pasted on the right just underneath the questions, because it's rather long for the chat. It might be easier.
Yes. It is fairly extensive. So before we dive into that, I just wanted to weigh in on this. I wanted to pick up on something Bob said as a registrar. You know, I think that I agree wholeheartedly with the BC here that, you know, if 99% of or more percent of transactions are legitimate, then this is a redundant step. However, it is an important fail-safe to help you unwind any sort of hijacks or illegitimate transfers. And I think one of the comments that was made when we were in Prague for IRTPC, the analogy we used is that the auth info code is kind of like if a domain name registration were a car, the auth info code would be the keys that start the car. But the FOA might be closer to the a closer analogy to the title or license plate to proof of ownership of the vehicle. You know, the analogy falls down in a couple of areas, but I think it was one way to help establish the difference. It's not enough just to have the keys to a car, a valet, or teenage child might have the keys to a car, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the owner. But I did want to pick up on something that Bob said, which was about consolidating these steps, and I think that perhaps there is some opportunity to discuss ways that the FOA, that we could preserve the usefulness of the FOA for disputes, but, you know, consolidate the FOA and the auth info into a single step. For example, I think registrars differ in the way that they present the auth info code, whether they show it on the screen or you know, it's in a copy to clipboard or something, or they send it to you via email. It seems like that if the FOA and the auth info code release process were merged, then perhaps it wouldn't feel so redundant. So that's just, you know, me weighing in here. Take my registrar hat off here and go back to the queue. Lars, is that new hand or...
This is Lars. Sorry, that's an old.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. So, Mikey, you want to weigh in on this before we dive into the statement from compliance?
This is Mikey. I think the question about whether to merge them, it's just a process note. I think that if we start to get into the merge discussion, we may become a design team because we'll have to map the old processes and all that kind of stuff. I'm a little cautious about that. Not opposed, but well, that's where we got into that deep dive in C. About the uses of the data elements and all that. stuff. So just sort of there'd be dragons.
That's a fair point, Mikey. And we don't want to presume that registrars communicate with their registrants all in the same way, and we don't want to tie their hands too much. And I think also, if we were to even float the idea, hypothetically, of merging this process, we still have answered Charter Question F. Does it eliminate it? And the answer is no, not eliminate. You know, make it more efficient, make it streamlined, whatever, merge, whatever we want to say, but we're still, even with that, we're saying not eliminate. But that's just a preliminary thought here based on still in brainstorming mode here. Don't want to give anybody the impression that I'm speaking out of school. But okay, so if we can maybe take a look. Lars, would you be so kind as to walk us through the statement from compliance? Or hang on a second. I'm sorry. Let's give the registry comment its proper attention, and then we'll put the ICANN compliance comment as if it were a third item in this list. So looking at comment now number 12 from the registry, the FOA is a key document in the transfer dispute resolution process, and the elimination of the FOA would critically impact it. It is the recommendation of the registry stakeholder group that the FOA requirement not be eliminated, given that a mechanism to capture information adequate to the document the chain of events that prove registrant authentication and authorization of the initiation of the transfer request would still be necessary to facilitate resolution of disputes. I think that they are, the registry comment is very assertively reinforcing what we said earlier, that, yeah, it may feel redundant from routine day-to-day stuff, but if there's ever a dispute, those FOAs become become golden, and we shouldn't be discussing elimination. Any other thoughts on the registry comment number 12 before we have Lars move to the ICANN statement? Okay, the queue is clear. Lars, would you mind walking us through the statement that you pasted from ICANN compliance?
This is Lars. So, what they're saying is legitimate transfers might seem redundant from start. You have the authentic code sent by the register name holder, the mandatory FOA, to the gaining registrar. But as they point out, for potential hijack, where contact details or email addresses have been stolen and illegal transfers are about to take place, the gaining registrar's obligation to obtain the FOA from either the registered name holder or the relevant admin contact, and that basically can help protect the domain names from being hijacked. Considering, as compliance point out, that the registered name holder to his contact information is different from the admin contact. And then the admin contact could potentially attempt to deny the transfer request, or at least they would be alerted of a transfer to take place and then take action against a potential hijacker. And then the final paragraph, they give the numbers that underline this, saying that 66% of all unauthorized transfers complaints that ICANN has received, 31 of 47, could have potentially been avoided if there was an obligation to obtain the FOA from the registered name holder. I think that's more or less what it says in those three paragraphs.
Okay. I have a question. I'm still reading through this here, but so it sounds like, at least for the first two paragraphs, that ICANN's contractual compliance statement is aligned with the statements that have been made both by the BC and the registry stakeholder group, as well as commenters on the call. I'm just trying to, maybe I just haven't had enough caffeine yet this morning. I'm trying to untangle that last paragraph, and I'm still kind of struggling with it here. Just a moment. Two-thirds of all unauthorized hijack requests or hijack or transfer requests, that at least those that were visible to ICANN compliance, could be denied or addressed by the admin contacts due to the gaining registrar's obligation to obtain the FOA. So is compliance then stating that the registrar did not obtain the FOA? Because they are currently obligated to do so. So that's why I'm a little confused here, is they're saying that, well, this could have been prevented by an FOA, but the FOA is currently required. So I'm a little, that's why I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around that. And I may be misreading it. Lars, Marika, any thoughts on here? Maybe we need to go back to compliance. I don't know if it's, maybe I'm misunderstanding. Lars, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it might be a good idea to go back to compliance. Sorry, this is Lars. But it might be to do with that there were unauthorized transfers. They might have slipped through whereby the admin contact didn't stop it when it could have done. And so they went through, and only then the issue was filed with ICANN. Whereas if there hadn't, so despite the FOA, this still happened in 31 cases in the past year. What ICANN is saying is that there might have been a lot more cases where the FOA actually did do its job and the admin contact did stop it before a hijack case gone through. But they don't have obviously any data of that because then no complaint was filed with ICANN. But I will get back to them and give you an answer next week, but that's my educated guess.
Okay. Well, I think it would be, sorry, it's James speaking again. I think it would be helpful to, you know, get a better handle on that, because I think that otherwise it starts to imply that registrars who were, that hijackers are targeting registrars who they know are currently, their practices are non-compliant with the existing obligations of the RAA. And I can tell you that I have heard anecdotally of at least one episode where a registrar thought that the FOA was optional. And certainly that was an interesting conversation. And I certainly want to make sure that we're not missing some other scenario, for example, where the FOA might have been forged or intercepted or some other thing that maybe we're not fully considering. But I think in general, just if I can kind of wrap up the conversation on this charter question, it sounds like we're all saying roughly the same thing, that the FOA may feel like an archaic or throwback bit of unnecessary administrative paperwork, but it is nevertheless invaluable when we try to undo a transfer that was unauthorized. And everything else around that, I think, is just more supporting information for our report. Mikey?
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I'm coming to the same conclusion I did on the last one, which is that we're pretty close to low-hanging fruit here, that our answer is no. Please don't eliminate FOAs. They're needed for all the reasons we've described.
I think that's a correct assessment as well, Mikey. And of course, we also have to look at what harm are FOAs causing to the collection. I mean, I suppose there's the potential for just extra automated emails that might put a registrar on someone's spam list or something. It's hard to imagine where an FOA is causing a critical problem. It may be a nuisance to registrants to have to acknowledge these FOAs or to receive them. It may be a nuisance for registrars to send them, but the potential benefits certainly seem to outweigh any downside. So I think, yes, your assessment is correct, Mikey. We'll probably start to button that up in our comments. Any other thoughts? The queue is clear, and we can move on to the last section here. Any other thoughts on charter question F? Okay. So this is now we're in the miscellaneous portion of our comment review tool. Any other comments to weigh in? The BC says that they have no further comments. That's nice and easy. And then finally, the registry stakeholder group, item number 14. The registries also wish to underscore the importance of explicitly addressing the role that resellers play in all of the issues that will be reviewed in IRTPT. Domain industry is changing, and vertical integration could amplify potential complications involving reseller relationships. While the registry does not have specific comments at this time on how resellers may or may not factor into each of these issues that will be considered by this PVP, we encourage the working group to explicitly consider reseller roles and to develop appropriate recommendations that might help minimize commonly misunderstood common misunderstandings about reseller responsibilities moving forward. I don't know that we have any of our colleagues from the registry stakeholder group on today's call, but I think what they are asking us to do is to explicitly, perhaps as an add-on for each charter question or as an overarching recommendation, prescriptively state how we want resellers to address both existing and potentially new obligations under the IRTP. If I can just editorialize here as a registrar, I would point out that resellers are explicitly mentioned in both the 2009 RAA and the 2013 draft RAA, as registrars are completely and totally responsible for the actions of their resellers and are not able to, subcontract out their obligations to resellers, that registrars are ultimately responsible, full stop. I don't know if that means that we should highlight that as part of this working group, if we have some specific guidance we need to be providing or best practices we could highlight, or if we just want to reference that chain of responsibility as it currently exists in the RAA. I think all of those are things that we could discuss if we feel that the current chain of authority is insufficient. Holly? Holly, you may be on mute. There you are.
Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you now.
Okay. Okay, I thought that resellers were under pretty much the same obligations under the RAA, although my reading is the same as yours, that ultimately your registrar is ultimately responsible. But I would have expected that resellers would be looking at the RAA and understanding that they're going to be held accountable for compliance in that way, although I suppose in the first instance, ICANN will go after the registrar, not them. But perhaps you'd like to correct me if I'm wrong?
I see Volker has raised his hand. I'll weigh in very quickly and then turn it over to Volker, who is also a member of the negotiating team. But essentially, in the existing RAA, registrars are responsible for all of their obligations, and whether they have a reseller involved or not, that doesn't alleviate their responsibilities and obligations. So ICANN compliance, because they had no relationship with the reseller, would go directly to the registrar. On the draft 2013 RAA, this is expanded just a little bit by also requiring that registrars enter into a reseller agreement with each of their resellers and that there be certain elements contained in that agreement. That's just a summary of what's in the draft. But we'll go ahead now with Volker. Go ahead.
Yes, James, you pretty much said what I wanted to say. There is no obligations of resellers towards ICANN directly. All the obligations that are included in the RAA are actually obligations for registrars to enforce against their resellers or to pass through to their resellers, but the obligation lies with the registrar, not with the reseller.
Thanks, Volker. Yes, and that is, I think, my understanding as well. So I hope that helps, Holly, but I think the short answer is that resellers themselves are not subject to ICANN compliance, but as a registrar, you better be darn sure you know what your resellers are doing late at night, because your accreditation is on the line. And if ICANN compliance says you didn't live up to some particular obligation, you are not allowed to say, well, that was a reseller, so I'm off the hook. I don't know if that helps, but I think that's one way we help to simplify and collapse this whole industry, because sometimes resellers will have resellers as well. So we certainly don't want to follow that chain down infinite number of rabbit holes. Bob, you're up next.
Yeah, thanks, James. This is Bob. I think based on that comment, I'm not sure what we would do with that as a working group, other than potentially, is there any direction, further direction, that the commenter could give in terms of what specifically they're looking, rather than directionally think about resellers when you're doing anything? Is there a little bit more specificity that could be provided, you know, that would just help us to understand the types of things they want to watch out for? I guess I find this to be really vague and doesn't give the work group a lot to act on.
Thanks, Bob. Maybe we should throw this back to the registries, particularly the members that we have on this PDP, none of whom are on the call, I should point out, but say essentially, you know, are you looking for something specific, or is it sufficient to reinforce that the existing responsibilities under the RAA, the draft 2013 RAA, is that enough? Are you looking for something more? And if so, you know, maybe have a longer discussion about that. So maybe we could throw that back to them. Holly?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, because otherwise, if you continue with the conversation this way, it sounds as if we're saying, well, registrars are under obligations and we're not sure about resellers. So I think we need to say we've had a discussion and this is the way that resellers are roped in. Otherwise, it looks as if we haven't addressed the issue.
Well, thank you, Holly. Yeah, I think it's probably a good course that you proposed. Mikey, here.
This is Mikey. I kind of liked your idea, James, which was, you know, there are several ways we could do this. We could just highlight some things or refer to them. I think that maybe, you know, I'm sort of putting words in the registry's mouth, but if I were in their shoes reading this comment, I think what they're asking is that we sort of remind people that resellers play a role in this, and sometimes that role is a little ambiguous. So registrars in the RAA have clearly deep responsibilities that they need to talk to their resellers about. I do tend to agree, though, that without a little bit more specificity, it's hard to know exactly what to do. I don't think we want to go through every single recommendation and say, oh, by the way, you resellers. But, you know, it might not be a bad idea to have a chunk of the findings that says that. It says, by the way, you resellers, these apply to you too. Just as a reminder. Anyway, I sort of talked myself into the ditch there. Sorry about that.
No, I think we're all kind of coming down on the same patch of ground here, is that we need to clarify. I think we all agree we need to clarify that what we think the registry stakeholder group is saying here is, in fact, the case. But if it is, that we don't want to build a new chain of authority or alter the existing chain of authority between registrars, or chain of responsibility, I guess, between registrars and their resellers, but we want to perhaps highlight or reiterate the existing chain of responsibility and point out that anything that's currently in IRTP, as well as anything new coming out of this working group, are are part of that set of responsibilities and make sure that all registrars are clear on that. And I think just as the last PDP in a chain of transfer working groups, it probably doesn't hurt to put an exclamation point on that concept in this final report to say that, everything that we've talked about, all going back to IRTPA, is holding on resellers as well. So, and we can reference the RAAs as well. So, I think we're going to that part. But all of this is predicated on the idea that we're not missing some salient point that the registries are trying to make. So I think that as one takeaway from this comment, we will circle back with our members from that constituency and make sure that we understand them completely. So that is the end of the comments received. Were there any other thoughts, comments, suggestions, questions? Anyone else want to weigh in on this? I currently have a empty queue. And it's still empty. So we're into now item number 3 on our agenda, but I noticed that we only have 6 minutes remaining in our call. So perhaps we can put that, I think that's a check-in with our work plan, if I'm not mistaken, Lars and Mikey. But we need to essentially check in where we are on our schedule, see what we have in front of us. We need to talk about the timing and structure of the Durban face-to-face meeting, which you probably knocked down today, at least get that topic started, and then we can confirm our next meeting. So can we talk a little bit, Lars, you wanted to discuss the face-to-face meeting. Is this structure or timing or both?
Hi, this is Lars. Thanks, James. Yes, I wanted just to confirm that we booked a 7:30 slot again as we had in Beijing. For Durban on Wednesday, because we thought that it didn't clash with anything. This is the most likely time where nothing else will be against it. And actually, the attendance both from working group and community members were actually rather good, we thought, in Durban, in Beijing, I'm sorry. So we keep it that way. And then, yes, if the group wants to discuss what they want to go in for the meeting agenda-wise, I'm happy to propose an agenda and turn around next week so we can post it on the website, but obviously we can also change that during the coming weeks, but it would be good to have something up on the side for the Durban meeting planners. I think that's it.
Okay, thanks Lars, and I think that's a good approach, is that we'll all confirm. Sorry folks, I think it's just the curse of the IRTP working groups and having so many of them that we always get stuck waking up at 7:30 in the morning. The good news is that we can always count on ICANN in previous meetings to provide coffee and juice and breakfast things, and hopefully they're not going to let us down again. So I'm sure they can't promise, but we're going to make them promise to caffeinate us and provide refreshments if they're going to get us out of bed that early. That's the Volkers.
The coffee and the croissants have been ordered, and it looks
oh, fantastic, excellent. Yeah, it's only fair, you know. I mean, when we have to get up that early, and I think to Volker's point, we sure know where we fall in the pecking order when you have your 7:30 meetings. I guess the alternative would be if you were meeting very late at night. So yes, and then as far as the agenda and the structure of that meeting, let's see if we could circulate something by the next call. And we can start adding that. If we can actually get something on the list prior to that, maybe we can even have some contributions from the working group on what they'd like to see. I'm not sure, you know, certainly our work plan doesn't target that we have an initial report for Durban, but I think we will be getting close some point thereafter. So, let's think about how we want this meeting to proceed, whether it's a full meeting of the working group, whether we have set aside some additional time to receive feedback on our work thus far from interested members of the community who don't participate in the PDP, or whether they just come in to drink our coffee and use our Wi-Fi. has also happened. So anyway, so that's something we can look for on the mailing list prior to next week's call, which will be at the same time, same channel. And I'll give you the last 4 minutes, Mikey. Is there anything you want to finish up here or bring us in for a landing?
No, this is Mikey. I think we did really well. I think we should give ourselves a round of applause for getting through the public comments and making, I think, pretty good strides towards tentative recommendation. You run back through those discussion summaries that we worked on last week, you'll see that unlike previous IRTP working groups, we don't really have a huge set of disagreements. We've got a bunch of things that we need to puzzle through, but this group feels pretty unified in where it's headed. So I'm pretty excited that, you know, we can move pretty fast towards an initial report after we go to Durban. And so we should take stock and say, yay, team. I think we did really well so far. Thanks, James.
Thanks, Mikey. Yeah, I agree with you. It sounds like, particularly with regard to the last two charter questions, the sentiment from today's call is that there's not a lot of controversy there. The other four, well, we've got some work to do, but it doesn't seem like there's any bitter divides that need to be bridged. But who knows? You know, we may uncover one yet. But I agree with you. We're making good progress. You know, I guess we can give ourselves attaboys and attagirls, but, you know, there were only two stakeholder groups weighing in, so it really wasn't that much of a heavy lifting to review these comments. But I think they were good comments. The quality was there if the quantity wasn't, and I think that the feedback was very relevant and helpful. So we can move on from here. We'll tackle this beginning next week. We'll revisit our work plan and make sure we're on track, see if we need to pick up the pace a little bit in some areas, which is always a good thing. And until then, thank you. Keep an eye on the list and enjoy your Monday.
Thank you.
Thanks James.
Thanks,
great
Mikey.
Job. See you all soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.